This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Physician Peter Ubel thinks the medical profession has got it all backwards. Doctors call the shots and patients listen obediently. But that's not the way it should be, Ubel says. Sure, doctors went to medical school and their advice should be considered. But when you face a tough medical decision, your doctor shouldn't be the only one involved. Peter Ubel wants to change the conventional doctor-patient dynamic, so he decided to write a book. It's called Critical Decisions, and it focuses on giving more power to the patient. Dr. Peter Ubel is a professor of marketing and public policy at Duke University, and he joins us in the studio today. Welcome, Peter. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
So what's wrong with the way we make our medical decisions today?
I don't think doctors or patients really know how to do this new dance that we call, you know, shared decision-making, where we know that the right choice is no longer just a matter of what the doctor thinks is right. I'm a physician, so I've been in this dance. I know that the right choice depends in part of what my patient cares about, what they value. But then whose decision is it? And in me studying even how doctors and patients have these conversations, nobody really knows where to be at. Some doctors are saying, no, it's your call. You make the decision. But doctor, I want your advice. Nope, that's not me to do. Other doctors are very dogmatic. They come right out, tell people what to do. Other doctors overwhelm people with information to the point their patients throw their hands up and say, help. And we really haven't learned how to work together as partners.
It's because this patient empowerment idea, this movement, if you want to call it that, I mean, it's been around for a few decades. We've been talking about it for a while.
We have.
And nothing, well, so go ahead, because that's, I mean, it's interesting to me that this is not a new conversation, and yet it still feels as though nobody, as you say, we still haven't gotten it right.
And I think it's partly because we've focused a lot of the conversation on rights. Who has a right to decide? Who can decide whether to pull the plug? A lot of the early patient empowerment cases were ones about people having the right to withdraw ventilators from their relatives and things. So we've got all this discussion of rights and never just the discussion of how.
Vocabulary has a lot to do with it. Obviously, you're well-educated. You've been to medical school. We've got words for these processes and these particles that are going wrong in your body, and they're not always words I know.
Sure. So now I know that as a doctor, I can't just tell you what to do. I have to tell you what's going on in your body. But I often end up using that Latin vocabulary that I absorbed in medical school, which has become second nature to me, and it's third nature to you. And it makes it hard to really work together when you don't understand what I'm saying.
So have you always been interested in this particular question?
It's one of the many questions I've been interested in for a long time, sure.
How did you get interested in it?
Well, partly just because I trained in medicine. I went to medical school in the mid-80s, and that was already about 10 years into what we'd call the patient empowerment revolution. And so I was taught that this was a job, this was something where I have to work better with my patients, but never really told how to. I was a person who was interested in moral philosophy and bioethics, so I came in really thinking, hey, I'm going to stand up for what's right for patients. And I honestly just found myself stumbling trying to make it happen.
Does the question of ethics or the study of ethics play any part in discovering the means to a better communication?
I actually think ethics tells us what the goal is, which is to work together. And then the how becomes almost more about social science and, you know, communication, decision making, understanding how those things work.
Well, that would seem to suggest that the DNA for the physician, that what they bring to the job, might be broader than what we think it is now. It's more than just sort of understanding the medicine and the science. You need to be a good communicator to be a good doctor.
For most specialties, yes. Maybe a radiologist only needs to communicate primarily to other physicians. That's okay. But I think a primary care physician, I think even a surgeon who's trying to help you decide whether you need that operation, ought to be a good communicator. I want them to be good more than just in the operating room. I want them to be good face-to-face.
At some point along the line, if we take you back in your biography, you thought it would be a great idea to be a philosopher. Tell us how you came to that.
Oh, no, I didn't say that. I said it would be a great idea to be a philosophy major in undergrad, which my dad said, well, what are you going to do with a philosophy major? And I said, Dad, what would I do without a philosophy major?
Oh, this is very philosophical.
Yeah, so he's still recovering from that answer. I was always asking. I like to ask questions and try to find answers to them, and philosophy was one way to do that. Science is another way to do that. I think the two complement each other quite well.
This came to you perhaps in a high school classroom where asking questions got you in trouble?
I was went to an all-boys Roman Catholic military high school. It's a trio of something.
Yeah.
And I just used to pepper the priests who taught me with more questions than they could answer. And that was how I just tackled most things in life. And I'd read something in the Bible literally between classes and then chase down a priest and say, hey, here it says that Jesus descended from David, but in this passage of the Bible, it goes through Joseph. I don't understand that because I didn't think his DNA was part of it. And we'd have some discussion. And I'm sure there are people out there who know more about the Bible than I do now who have a good answer to that. But I was always looking for answers.
Genealogy is one question. Evolution was another question that got you, or at least a teacher, stumped.
Yeah. I had a biology teacher. I totally admired the guy. And he taught – we read a book on evolutionary of the evolution of intelligence. And he wanted us as critical thinkers – this was an AP, one of the early AP classes – to find the flaw in this guy's argument, which was that how could humans be so much smarter than every other animal on the planet without God helping out? And that's certainly a theory. But I looked at that and said, and argued back with him. I said, well, isn't it possible that we just – there were other smart animals around and we just killed them? And, you know, I think
– we're not smarter. We're meaner than the rest of them.
More successful at killing. I think most animals are pretty – right? And it turns out, you know, that's closer to what we now know is true, that there were other smart Homo sapiens – not Homo sapiens, but other types out there. And we probably either killed them or actually we have some of them, their DNA in us because we reproduced with them.
We mated with them. Well, yeah, it also seems to me that if you're going to decide to define yourself as the most intelligent and you're the one who defines intelligence, the fix was in from the start, isn't it? I mean, there's lots of different kinds of intelligence. So, you know, if I can get to the tree faster than you, I have a kind of physical intelligence that you don't have.
Yeah, no, and I'm a huge fan of multiple intelligences, that there's a lot, you know, and when you go through medical training and you see people who lose just the ability to remember names and realize, hey, there's one part of the brain where you remember names. I don't have that part of the brain, by the way. yeah, there's a lot of different kinds of intelligence. But I still think there's a lot – you could say it's not hard to argue that humans have a kind of intelligence no other animal has, an amount, you know, that we control the world in ways through our minds that no one other animal does. But that doesn't mean it couldn't have evolved.
Well, yeah, and that it is unique doesn't make it superior. You can't make the value judgment based on its uniqueness. It's simply one of many kinds of survival strategies, one that hasn't proved itself in terms of longevity compared to some other animals. The proof isn't in yet in terms of how well this strategy does for a beast that's been around, well, maybe 100,000 years or so.
Yeah, no, I
when
I hear
you reckon that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So, and that seems to me to bring us back in some ways to how you communicate with patients, because the value set of the physician who
I'm very
has
interested in this connection, by the way.
stand by. It won't take long. The value set that you bring to the question, how I as the patient visualize what's going on with me and what that means, what the various therapies you say that you suggest mean. Will it mean I lose work? What's it going to mean with my relationship? And you're saying, no. Here's how we get those leukocytes to go up or down or whichever way you want them to go. That's how we do this. And I'm looking at its impact on my family, whether I'm embarrassed to be sick. I mean, all those other questions that are a set of values that you as the physician who don't share my life don't have.
And I'd say that what I've been trying to do is to help all of us in medicine understand that medical care is not about biology specifically, just about chemicals or about x-rays. It's about understanding the impact that health and illness have on people's lives and trying to reduce that impact. And that sometimes means spending more time talking about someone's life than about their blood pressure.
Is that a tough sell? Is that something that has to happen in medical school? Do medical schools have to be restructured in a sense to allow more time for that kind of training?
I think we're trying in medical school to emphasize that much more than we used to. I think what happens, though, is we go further through our training and we get it trained out of us. And so we certainly want to select medical students not just on the basis of their ability to understand physics and biology and chemistry, but on their social intelligence, emotional intelligence. We need to do that. Not easy to do, but we want to emphasize that. But then I think once they get into the hospital, we need to make sure that the people mentoring them are emphasizing these things. Because you can get a lecture about how to behave, and then you see everyone else and what they're doing, guess what wins?
Well, that then suggests that the reward system, what we consider a success, has mm-hmm. to be pretty clearly understood and evaluated, because if my success is getting you in for the colonoscopy and out, cha-ching, well, then I've succeeded. Your well-being may be a harder thing to measure, and I don't know how to measure that as success or count it as success.
Right. And so we're trying to develop measures of patient satisfaction that capture really valid capture valid measures of how good the medical care is, and that's starting to get how doctors are paid. It matters how you talk, how you communicate.
And yet, if you're trying to communicate with me and I'm the one who has now been given this diagnosis, my emotions figure into this in a way that might make it difficult to make a rational. I mean, those are my leukocytes you're talking about.
Yeah, so when I wrote Critical Decisions, I didn't write this for doctors. I wrote it for general public, because I think you need to understand what's going on in your doctor's mind and in your own mind when you face these important times in life. But ultimately, I can't read people's minds, but I can ask them questions that reveal what's going on in their minds, and that's what I'm pushing for. I want us to just talk, to engage with each other. I think most of the answer is there.
On the State of Things today, talking with physician Peter Ubel. He is a physician and professor of marketing and public policy at Duke University. And our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking to Dr. Peter Ubel, physician and professor of marketing and public policy at Duke University and author of Critical Decisions, How You and Your Doctor Can Make the Right Medical Choices Together. So I'm curious to know how you went from philosophy to med school. Which came first?
Philosophy came first. I mean, but in college, I was, I think a lot of undergrads don't know what they're going to do when they grow up. And for me, I knew I liked science. I knew I liked people. And it felt like medicine was a great mix of the two. And I knew I didn't like science like sitting in a laboratory. I just like learning about science, but I liked interacting with people. And medicine is a great career for that.
So you went to med school. Do you have any specialties in mind or when you went into med school?
I did not. I pursued every single one. I knew pretty quickly I wasn't going to be a surgeon, but I looked into radiology and physical medicine rehabilitation, thought about psychiatry, pediatrics. I looked at lots of them. Then I ended up in internal medicine, adult primary care.
And your romance with philosophy and ethics, in a way, got you in trouble, didn't it? Did it actually almost get you kicked out of a fellowship when you started asking questions about it?
Oh, boy. You're just bringing out all the low life to my life. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I really hope to be back on the show again soon. So I was at the University of Pittsburgh. I was a fellow actually studying ethics at the time. And I had encountered a case while training at the Mayo Clinic of a man who died after receiving a fourth liver transplant. So he rejected a couple organs, and the third liver just didn't work at all. And he put a fourth one in, and the guy still died. And I knew that a lot of people were waiting for livers, for their first liver, and dying before they could get one. And I wondered how this guy got a fourth. So I read the literature. I got data from the national group that collects records of how well people do after the transplants. And I showed that first transplant does better than the second. Second is better than the third, et cetera. And wrote an article saying, I think we need to stop at two, except in rare circumstances. Circulated to the head of the transplant program there. He's a world leader in transplant at Pittsburgh at the time. And he basically tried to get me kicked out of the fellowship because he thought I was asking the wrong questions.
Well, it's interesting.
As in questioning him.
You know, questioning him, I suppose it could be an ego problem because, I mean, from a strictly business standpoint, there are enough people in line so that you don't have to give four to one person. It's not like you're going to shut down his practice with a paper.
Yeah, it's not
like
about
that.
Business, of course. I mean, in part it is if I'm waiting for my first transplant, you, the surgeon, haven't opened my body up and put a new organ in me. You don't have that same connection to me that you have to this guy who you've operated on several times. And so I think to the surgeon, you felt that special responsibility to help out. And I understand that. And that's where a part where I saw here's the ethics of it, but there's the psychology of it too. And that's when I started kind of merging my interest in ethics with my interest in behavior, because it was totally understandable why he felt that way.
But then, so when you get back to your thesis now in Critical Decisions, the idea that doctors and patients should be more engaged in a conversation and that patients should certainly have more to say about it. here you are. I have a chance at a fourth liver. Ethics be damned. Give me 30 of them. I want another chance. Now, mm-hmm. When does medical expertise and public policy mm-hmm. Sort of play a role and step in a way, and take away from you that power or right, yeah. if you prefer?
Oh, I think there has to be times where you have some, I won't say higher authority, but the system has to make some decisions, right? And I think somebody has to come in and say, we can't be giving priority to people waiting for a third and fourth liver over others. And the system can make that decision better than an individual doctor and patient, because they're really interested in that patient's outcomes. And so we actually have quite a good transplant allocation system here that very rationally decides who's next in line. And we've worked on it together and revised it over the years, and it's much better than just being done at the bedside.
What's the limit of that, though? I mean, if you think about – I mean, this seems to me that the fundamental problem of sort of rational health care is mm-hmm. that while we have power over life and death, we don't have authority. We're not the authors. And we keep brushing up against this question of who has the right to decide when life begins, when mm-hmm. we can pull the plug, at what point. You know, power is one thing, but mm-hmm. authority is another. And that seems to be the thing we fight over.
Sure. And when it comes to a scarce resource like transplantable livers and hearts, we don't have enough to go around. I think we need to have a more social consensus about how we should give out those organs. And we have groups that are made up of transplant experts, but also have community participants on it that are setting the rules. Now, that's different than deciding, should I do this blood test to screen you for prostate cancer, even though a recent task force said maybe it's not doing you any good? And who's going to stop me and my doctor from deciding whether to get that blood test? That's a much different thing. You know, maybe an insurance company could say we're not going to pay for it, but I don't see that happening.
But the resources, right? I mean, you talk about the allocation of resources yep. in terms of organs, but resources are what are required for research, for development, and for the allocation of medicine. So we have that famous 90-10 split, where 90% of the money goes into research for 10% of the population, the people who are wealthy enough to have cancer and live long enough, and heart disease. Meanwhile, malaria goes begging, where it's a disease that affects more people. That's an allocation question.
Yeah, I agree. And it's one where it's not absolutely scarce in the same way that we only have 150 livers coming out this month or whatever. But you're right. You spend money on one thing, you're not spending it on something else. And we need to have debates about that aren't just between the doctor and the patient mm-hmm. at the bedside. I do think we need other groups to get in and enter into this.
So getting back to your book, Critical Decisions, what prompted you to actually write this book?
Well, partly, again, my struggle with patients, trying to involve them in their decisions. I opened the book up with the story of a guy who had localized prostate cancer. He knew he could have surgery, radiation, or active surveillance. He was torn, didn't know what to do, and said, "Doc, what should I do?" I said, "It's not for me to decide. It's your call." He just hated me saying that. So I said, "What are you watching on TV tonight?" He said, "Oh, I'm going to go watch the hockey game." I said, "Bad idea. You should watch the figure skating competition on Channel 17. He hated figure skating. He told me, "What are you, crazy?" I said, "No, that's my point. I can't tell you what to watch on TV because it depends on your values. That's why I can't tell you what to do if you're prostate cancer." He said, "Okay, doc, then what would you do if you were me?" And he got it and yet still wanted my advice. And I sat there thinking, you know, I don't know what my role is here anymore. Am I just informing them and helping them figure out what fits with their values? Or am I telling them what to do and making them comfortable with my recommendation?
Yeah. Well, and it seems to me then the question of identity is crucial here. What if you were me? Which means the more you know about him, the more you can sort of replicate his
Absolutely.
Mindset, right?
That's the key. It really is. I think you want to do a brain biopsy, right? You want to understand what's going on in their heads. And so ask, well, what are you afraid of? What are you thinking of? Tell me, here's the trade-off. You live with a cancer inside you, versus you have maybe impotence or incontinence. Just tell me, what does it make you feel right now? I just want to hear your take on it. And that's a great way to start. Then if they don't want to be alone in making the decision, say, okay, well, from what I've heard, it sounds like surgery is best for you. Does that feel right? And that conversation
right,
continues.
And then it continues. Yeah. Is this something we should test for in medical school? The ability to ask those kinds of questions and that kind of interpersonal skill?
Yeah, I think we could. Yes. And so partly we do have sometimes where we videotape students interacting with either standardized patients or actual patients. We should critique them for these kind of communication skills. I think there are other times you can lay out a medical scenario for people and say, Tell me where patient values might determine the right choice here. Just being able to identify whether something is medically right or wrong, or whether it depends on patient values. We don't train people to do that.
How big a role do families play in this decision-making process?
A huge role. It's definitely not a decision just between a doctor and a patient. It's often between a healthcare team made up of doctors and nurse practitioners, et cetera, and a family.
Now, that can get really complicated because they have competing interests and competing ideas and different relationships with the patient. So it seems to me it gets complicated and confusing right away.
Sure. Life is complicated and important decisions. You don't want to go into them with blinders on. Ultimately, it's if the person whose body it is has the final say, and I will defend their right to make that final determination against their family if I have to, but usually most people want to work together with their family and their doctors and have everybody happy.
You've written three other books. Tell us a little bit about them and whether or not there's a link, a way that these books all come together. Are they?
Sure. My first book was called Pricing Life. It was about really what we talked about a minute ago, about these decisions about how much to spend and who makes those decisions, the ethics and the psychology of that, and economics. The next book I wrote was – which was my next book? You're Stronger Than You Think, which is about our inability to predict how we're going to feel when we become sick or disabled, and that we often think things that are going to make us miserable don't. And we think things that we'll be able to brush off our shoulders can drag us down, and it's trying to help people understand that better.
You know, when it comes again to this sort of putting it on the patient or asking the patient to think more deeply about it, of course, this is a highly emotional time for the patient. We don't think rationally ever. I mean, I think all of our decisions are thankfully involve some kind of emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. Is this about the worst time in the world to be asking somebody to be talking about their own health when they're in this state?
It's certainly not a time you can expect people to be at the top of their game in terms of rational weighing of pros and cons. Yes. So partly, how about taking time when we have it and let those emotions subside a little bit? And then maybe the job isn't to make the patient into a decision maker, but to just understand enough of what the patient cares about that you can kind of hold their hand and guide them through a decision that fits them well.
Things have changed, though. You tell the story about Betty Ford, and you use her as an example of sort of what went on with her and her diagnosis and how things have changed.
Yeah, in 1975, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and was basically told, even before the diagnosis, we're suspicious of what we're feeling in your breast. We're going to put you under. We're going to do a biopsy. And if we find a cancer, we're taking it out. And that meant getting her a radical mastectomy that already they were starting to learn was probably overly aggressive, unnecessarily aggressive. But the doctor didn't give her a choice. He knew what was best for her, and he kind of basically said, here's what you need to do, and she obediently did it.
Things have changed a little bit, at least in terms of that procedure. Our understanding of it has changed. But then that also leads to the question of how much we trust medical technology. It changes a lot, and opinions often reverse, and that leaves people who stay in the know, non-professionals who stay in the know, a little bit skeptical about the latest information. You think, well, how soon will it be until the latest is overturned?
Oh, absolutely. And, so even if doctors don't know what's right or wrong or their minds change from day to day, it's hard to imagine any patient getting up to speed and knowing what's right or wrong. On the other hand, just knowing when there's uncertainty can help, because then a strong value you hold can push you one way or another. You say, oh, we're not sure. We're worried that this is the kind of tumor that might be aggressive, but we have no evidence of it. Okay, well, I'm worried about you operating in my body, so let's slow down.
Mm. Right? We talked about the authority of the doctor and the fact that patients often consider doctors the experts. So I'm in your hands, doc. What should I do? But in fact, in a lot of ways, neither the doctor nor the patient has the choice. The insurance company can end up saying, thanks for your opinion, doc, but we don't think it's necessary and we're not going to pay for it.
Yeah, it's a group decision now. And that's it's a burden, and yet it's necessary, because otherwise we just spend without anything to slow us down. Fight your doctor. A good doctor will fight back when you really need something, and they'll get through whatever hurdles are put in their way. And, you have rights as a patient to fight that too. But there are times where this is a signal that what you're asking for, that there's not good evidence for it, and that it costs a lot of money to a lot of people and might not be worth it.
Well, I mean, the money part is certainly important for insurance companies. The good evidence part is again, that's kind of subjective, and they tend to choose what works best for them.
Oh, no, it's not entirely subjective. We're working harder to be much more evidence-based in how we practice medicine. We're striving. We're not ever going to be perfect because the science keeps advancing, but we're working hard for that.
So you've got the doctor, the patient, and now we've added the insurance company, and then there are the drug companies who advertise. So then we've got a different kind of advocacy where the patient is well aware of exactly what they need and precisely what the medicine is. I saw it on the TV. Doc, give it to me.
Sure. And I think that could lead to really good conversations with your doctor, because now the doctor knows about the symptoms you have, and maybe the pill that you heard on the ad isn't right for you, but now the doctor might attend to your physical needs more. So I have no problems with people coming in and asking for drugs that they've heard advertised. My problem is if the doctors think, oh, the easiest thing to do is just give them a prescription and move on to the next patient. It's really a chance to engage.
Well, it is, unless the patient is convinced by what they saw on the TV and then says, it's time for me to move on to the next doctor.
Sure. I've had people get rid of me as their doctor. But you have to do what's right. At some point, if someone wants antibiotics, I say, I am not comfortable prescribing them to you. I think they're going to cause you more side effects than they're worth it. I know you want them, but let me explain again why. And at some point, they go find another doctor to give them antibiotics. That's their right.
Are there pressures on doctors? I mean, apart from training, being trained in this kind of practice or not, are there pressures on doctors not to engage in this kind of treatment and then in this kind of dialogue?
Time pressures are huge. I do think that good communication takes no longer than bad communication and often is more efficient because you get to the point better. But I think that part of the communication problems is because doctors are under so much pressure to move right to the next patient. You often get in, you're already an hour behind, right? Mm-hmm. So how is that person going to make you feel like you have time to tell what you care about? And so I think that's one big pressure. And I think the other is just we think we know what our patients want, and so we rush to meet their expectations. And I've seen, again, I've done research on this, where you saw prescriptions for antibiotics to kids who had viruses, and antibiotics are no good for a virus. But the doctor thought that's what the parent wanted, and they never really found out.
Mm. Well, or the famous secondary infection. Well, this is a viral, but now your immune system's compromised, so we'll prevent the secondary infection.
Yeah. And usually you're better waiting for that secondary infection.
Right.
Unless they have some real illness.
So getting back to the time pressures, again, that's the way clinics are structured right now. And again, because of the way the insurance companies and clinics are set up, that's how the time is allocated. What would it take to change that? That strikes me as a fundamental change in the structure of the way medical care is delivered.
Yeah, so we definitely need to pay for medical care so that when people spend time talking to patients and learning them and examining them, diagnosing them, that gets well reimbursed rather than just now where we basically pay well for that 2-second biopsy you do or little procedure. But I think what I often emphasize to medical audiences is if you want to avoid lawsuits, which is on the back of many, which on the forefront of many doctors' minds, good communication is probably the best way to prevent malpractice suits, because you can do 10 seconds of an audio interaction between any doctor and patient, and from their tone of voice of the physician, you have a good ability to predict whether they're going to get sued in their life. Authoritarian, dogmatic physicians who rush their patients through the visit when something bad happens are way more likely to get sued than ones who are perceived as empathetic and caring.
You've done the research on this?
I have not. I wish I had. No.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and again, that's a training issue. It seems to me, in terms of how you treat the patient, not so much a structural one. You can do that in a 15-minute visit if you choose to change your tone.
Mm-hmm. You can definitely train people to just even acknowledging what people are saying, acknowledging their emotions when they have it, making sure to give them time to talk. You can train it in, and they can a couple simple rules. Doctors will do it, and they'll probably be motivated to do it if they understand that it means they won't get sued.
But again, and again, when you look at the structure and you pointed to it a second ago, you get paid for the procedure. You get paid for the time. You don't get paid for the outcome. So the patient dies and you saw him, you get paid for the visit, right? Is there a reasonable way to assess outcomes? And remember, we don't want doctors picking the healthiest patients to get the best outcomes to get the highest pay. So we have to worry about that. We just want to pay you for a cure. But is there a rational, fair way to assess outcomes and get paid for that?
We're working on that. The global we, but trying to measure when someone's getting good quality care is hard. If you look, for example, at mortality rates after bypass surgery, you know, big heart surgery in your heart, it seems like you should reward the physicians whose patients have the lowest mortality rate. But one way to have a low mortality rate is to operate on the healthier patients.
Right. Right.
And so now you try to adjust your statistical model for how healthy people were, yada, yada. But if that model doesn't capture everything, then the doctors know how to find the people who are going to do better than the model would predict, and they operate on them.
We do it like the Olympics, degree of difficulty. We just raise the degree of difficulty, and the points the points go up. I guess that wouldn't work.
But probably work as well as it does in the Olympics.
There you go. Not good enough. But as you suggest, there's ways around that. There's ways for you to analyze, even with degree of difficulty, how you can succeed and not.
So we're trying our best to measure the quality of care in ways that make sense, to even put that out there so people can use it when they're deciding what doctor or what hospital to go to. It's an evolving science.
Talking to Peter Ubel today. He's a professor of marketing and public policy at Duke University. We'll talk more about public policy when our conversation continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking to physician Peter Ubel. Peter Ubel is a professor of marketing and public policy at Duke University. He's got a new book called Critical Decisions. Just came out this fall, and in it he writes about ways to improve a doctor-patient relationship and give patients more say in their own treatment. And, Peter, you also teach a course on Obamacare at Duke.
Officially, the introduction to the U.S. healthcare system.
I see. Well, the president likes to call it Obamacare as well because you have the president's name associated with care. But tell us how this course came about and what do you teach?
Well, in introducing people to the U.S. healthcare system, I got syllabi from a bunch of people around the country, and it would be one topic would be Medicaid, one would be Medicare, another day would be on this and that. It looked really dry, and I thought, well, we need a good story here. And the real story is that we have this huge law that passed that we're still fighting over, and that we had decades of people fighting to try to reform the health system before it. And so rather than a lecture on Medicare, how about the fight that took place to get Medicare to happen, how unpopular that was for a while before now it's universally embraced. And so we basically – that's the design of the story. The first class you come in, for those who are taking the class in January, you have a foreshadowing here. and here's what the healthcare system looked like when Obama came into office. And now your goal is tell us how to fix it. That's their first assignment. And then we try to figure out how we got into the mess we are in. Or were in at that time. And then we look at all the debates, all the battles over birth control pills and individual mandates and whether insurance companies should be there or we should have a public option, all those battles. We really dig into them. It's fun.
What is the mess that we were in? And we're not quite out of yet.
Yeah.
What is that mess?
Well, compared to any developed country in the world, we had a higher percentage of people who had no access to health insurance. I mean, a staggering number of people. We have then, in addition, by far the highest cost of healthcare in the world, nobody even a close second. And then our quality in some places really great, and other places the quality of our care lagging far behind other developed countries. So kind of plus we got about maybe a B minus grade on quality, and then when it comes to access and cost, probably F.
Mm. Michael Porter's take on this a while ago, of course, the Harvard MBA mm-hmm. prof who said, well, the problem is pure competition. If this were actually a market system, it would fail on every score because the competitors aren't in touch with each other. It should be a patient saying, I want the best care, and the mm-hmm. doctor, and they would evaluate that. But you have this third party now, insurance companies, very mm-hmm. complicated system.
I would have to disagree. We should get on the show and debate each other at some mm-hmm. point. And I think even in critical decisions, what I try to show is that these decisions are so hard to make that you see people relying on their doctors. Who is the decision maker? Well, it's as much the doctor as the patient. And who is the consumer? It's not a normal free market where I come in. What patient comes up to the doctor and says, well, doctor, how much is that chemotherapy going to cost? I'm going to go see if I can find someone who will offer it to me cheaper. Or is there another chemo around that might be less expensive? Nobody talks that way. Plus, you don't even know what the cost is to the individual patient, so we're not even discussing these things. And the doctors feel like it'd be inappropriate for them to talk about it.
So what is it? How is it that we have, triple the cost of developing countries and not mm-hmm. quite the outcome's not quite as good? Where are some of these costs?
Oh, let's see. Who do I want to alienate now? physicians in the United States, we make a lot more money than our counterparts in Europe. And we don't do a whole lot more procedures than many other countries. So it's not really just from what we're doing. It's how much we're getting paid for doing it. Hospitals get well reimbursed, too. We also pay more for our medications here in this country than most people do in other parts of the world. So pharmaceutical industry makes a lot of its profits here rather than elsewhere. They can't charge the same prices in England that they can charge here often.
Well, it's kind of interesting because one of the arguments against so-called socialized medicine is that the cost will go crazy because the government's running it and the government bureaucrats really don't care about costs. They just let the price tag go up. But the good old free market, that'll keep costs down.
And it works. The free market works well for things like plastic surgery, for laser surgery for your eyes, right? Because the people are paying completely out of pocket for that. And so they're much savvier consumers then. But it doesn't work very well for how to get your heart attack taken care of. People aren't sitting ready to be savvy consumers and negotiate prices then.
But in these countries where there are so-called socialized systems, where there's a national health care, those procedures are offered. And the prices seem to be, or at least the total cost per capita, are lower. How'd they do that?
Well, you know, it's not about whether it's socialized or nationalized or not, because there are countries like Germany, they have private health insurance companies, but they're a heavily regulated market. Their costs are lower than us. Then you go to the United Kingdom, and that's basically socialized medicine. Their costs are way lower, but people complain about long queues to get into things. Go to Canada, the doctors are privatized, but the insurance is through the government. So there's all kinds of models out there. Everybody's cheaper than us, but no one model works, and you kind of have to go off the system you have.
So what do the students say when they come in terms of what are some of the ideas they have for fixing this thing?
You know, they come in knowing relatively little because, you know, they're 19, 20-year-old kids who've been healthy their whole lives. Maybe they've gone in with an ankle sprain or something. But they come in with a lot of their parents' thoughts in their back of their mind. So some people come in pro-Obama. Some people come in anti-Obama. At the end, I want them to be too confused to know what they think.
That's great. Well, that's a terrific goal. And I hope to see you sometime about this thing on my back. Well, it's interesting that you would say that they're pro-Obama and anti-Obama, because, again, even when it comes to national policy, we can't really be rational about it. If you don't like the president, then you don't like his plan, I mean, in some ways.
Yeah, we did a study recently where we brought out the whole question of whether Obamacare has death panels that claim that Sarah Palin made when they were writing the legislation. And we found that if people loved Palin, they believed the claim. If they hated her, they didn't believe it. But then for half of the people in our study, we debunked it. We put some fact-checking in there. What we found is that people who had some basic knowledge of politics and they loved Palin, when they were confronted with this fact-checking, what do you think happened?
They ignored it and said you were lying.
They believed in the claim even more than they did before.
Yeah.
I think that's part of what I try to get across in the course is it's really hard to objectively view these kind of political battles because you come in with something at stake. And if your party or identity is wrapped up with that party that you belong to or the ideology you've embraced, when it's threatened, you hold on to it even more tightly.
Right. And then when you get not only the personalities involved, the party politics, but some of the moral issues involved, if you're talking about birth control and whether that should be included, does that weigh into the arguments in your classroom?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, that was a raging controversy last spring when we were doing it. It'll be a big one again this year, I think, because there can be lawsuits about it. And now there are employers saying they don't want to offer birth control through insurance, even though they're not even religious organizations, but the CEO is religious in some way. It would be fun to debate, and that's something that college students do have an interest in, is trying to understand, you know, things like birth control. The women in the classroom tend to be relatively quiet, and the guys have a lot of strong opinions when we have those debates.
Really?
Yeah. I think that the women are a little embarrassed to talk about what this really might cost them if they're on birth control. And I tell you, the guys don't know what it costs them.
Well, they don't know what it costs them. They probably don't know how it works at this point. I'm just saying they could run for Senate in some states. Well, then talk about that. I mean, we've got a state that says, I don't care how high the sea level rises, we're not going to measure it. And then we won't know. So, I mean, we're actually at a point in 2012 where you can have rational people say, I don't want to know the truth. And I will write that into law. That's pretty rough.
It's sad. Yeah, that's why, you know, I think that we just need to know the facts and then let's find out where our values are. And then, but if we disagree on values, that's fine. Let's acknowledge it. If we're disagreeing on facts, let's find the facts. Don't let our values get in the way of what we believe the facts are.
All right. So we've done that. Now, so we have as your brothers in the legal profession would say, we have stipulated to the facts. However, it is my religious conviction here that's going to weigh in much more heavily than what those facts say, because now we have to make a decision, and I'm going in this direction because it's a religious belief and it has nothing to do with public policy or those facts.
Are we still talking about birth control?
Why not?
Okay, sure. Let me tell you that when the Obama administration said that insurance companies need to cover birth control, that was based in part on what the Institute of Medicine said about what are basic preventive medical care, that this is something that lowers the cost of health care to the population at large by preventing unwanted pregnancies. And so it was based on this scientific recommendation. Now, nobody is forcing anybody to take birth control that doesn't want to take it either. So I think when people talk about freedom being impinged upon, that's a kind of weak argument. So as a physician, I have to say I support the idea that insurance companies should cover this, because I think it means that people are more likely to take birth control who should be taking birth control.
That is an interesting question, though. I mean, just the way you put that, there's a public policy that says everybody would be healthier if this were available, and therefore as a medical outcome, as a thing we want to cover as an insurance company, for instance, we want to lower medical costs. It should be available. As a company that doesn't believe in this, that has a management structure, we simply can't offer that because it violates our moral code.
And then I'd say watch out if you work for a company whose CEO is a Christian Scientist. Does that mean you get no health insurance because they don't believe in that? Or maybe a Scientologist and you don't get to have coverage for mental health care? And I don't think we want CEOs making those kind of decisions.
Right. And so then that brings us back to the public policy question. You may believe that as a CEO, and that might be how you want to run your company. And then you are also subject to the laws of this state and the nation. And those laws get made in terms of public policy, we hope.
Mm-hmm.
So when does the government then have that right to step in and make essentially medical decisions based on the best evidence available at the moment?
Yeah, I think we need as a society to decide what basic health insurance coverage everyone should get. And I do think turning to medical experts is part of that process. And I think I don't know any medical expert who would say that mental health care should not be part of any basic health coverage. And so I respect the CEO's beliefs to not want to pursue mental health care for themselves or their family, but not for their employees.
Now, I know you've spent time in a lot of different medical settings, including VA hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And that is basically socialized medicine.
It is, yeah.
And they rank pretty high in terms of at least record keeping and some other care.
More than just record keeping and quality of care.
Good
outcomes for patients. Patients get really good medical care there and actually at a very reasonable cost. Means sometimes waiting a little longer for things. It means sometimes saying we don't have that medicine on our formulary. You have to take this one instead. But overall, and I think those decisions are made really intelligently for the best of that population at large. So yeah, I've been very proud to practice in the VA system.
So how does it work? And I think that between the VA and Medicare, Medicaid, that accounts for about 50% of medical spending in the United States.
Yeah.
All of it socialized.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of complaints about that. Most of the complaints you hear about private care and being sort of thrown off the rolls and being denied service. Hmm. So I'm questioning just the VA. Let's stick with the VA for a minute.
Sure.
Is that scalable?
No? I think, again, the VA system, no one is forced to go into it. It's often some people choose. Some people have very little other options because they maybe have financial troubles, and because if they were in the military, they get some coverage. But I think if you impose that system on people, you're going to get a backlash. And
was that just because people don't like to be told what to do, or because
sure.
It wouldn't? But otherwise, everything about the system structurally,
if the
could
system
work.
Had evolved to where we had everything was like a VA system. We had one electronic medical record system that connected to every hospital in the country. We had negotiating power with pharmaceutical companies, et cetera. My guess is people would be largely happy. You know, it depends how well the system ran. If it ran as well as a VA, I think they'd largely be happy. But, you know, it's a little bit like the QWERTY keyboard. It's a terrible way to design a modern keyboard. It was designed for keyboards where those little levers came up, right? Try to redesign one and make it succeed in the market.
Right.
You've got to work with the system you've got and revise that system. You can't start from scratch.
So how do you see that happening? Doctor, if you were me, how would you revise my medical system?
Well, I think what the Obama administration is trying to do is to, first off, increase access to health insurance. and that's a major accomplishment of the law. And second is they want to regulate the insurance industry more, tell you that you can't say no to people because they have pre-existing conditions, tell them they can't raise their rates more than a certain amount per year without giving a darn good explanation, telling them what they have to cover. And so it's a more regulated insurance industry, one that will still make profits for the insurance companies, but one that and will cover more people.
In your course, you say you look at the debates beginning with Medicare and now with the latest health care proposal and law. Has the debate changed much? How has it changed over public policy and the medical system?
Which debate?
The debate about government involvement in the regulation or the delivery of medical care.
Well, I'd say that the world shifts all the time where what the administration put together in a law would have looked pretty much like what Nixon would have proposed back when he was president.
Why do you say that?
Well, because that's the effort that, you know, the people who were working with Nixon to try to do healthcare reform were looking. They wanted to push up managed care. They wanted to have a combined private. They wanted to keep insurance companies in the game, et cetera. The ground kind of shifted when the Democrats moved to what looked like it was in the center. That quickly became the left. And, you know, it's like team sports. You root for the jerseys, right? And when one team says, we don't like that guy, you know, even though he used to be on your team last year, you don't like him anymore. And I think it's the same thing. That idea used to be, the individual mandate used to be, that was started by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, and now it became kind of liberal, bad idea to many people because the other team claimed it.
What about, so Nixon failed essentially because he lost the center if it was coming from Nixon, it had to be a right-wing idea. So why did he fail?
No, well, I mean, there was this thing called Watergate that kind of broke a lot of his momentum, right? And so that's what happened. And so, yeah. And then, you know, Reagan came in with not wanting to grow any part of the government outside of the military very much. Bush, the first, started embracing health care reform, but only when it was too late and Clinton got elected. We know what happened with Clinton when that fell apart. Lots of people tried to reform the healthcare system, and Obama, you know, 40 years later, he's the first one to actually make big changes.
Well, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Peter Ubel is a physician and a professor of marketing and public policy at Duke University. His new book, Critical Decisions, How You and Your Doctor Can Make the Right Medical Decisions Together, came out this fall. That's the State of Things for today. Thank you for listening to our program. You can find us at stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados and produced by Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Haley Sklut is our intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.